I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more provocative and engaging books you'll read is a new one from Jessica Crispin. In Why I Am Not a Feminist, a Feminist Manifesto, she writes of how feminism has lost its way and how the word feminist has lost its meaning, to the point that she disavows the word and the movement that's become co-opted to become banal, polite, and popular. She calls for a revolution, and dismantling the system that encourages oppression should be the goal by everybody. I'll get Jessa to tell us about this book and more. She is the founder and editor of the online magazine Book Slut and the online literary journal Spolia. Her two previous books are The Dead Ladies Project and The Creative Tarot. She has written for The New York Times, The Guardian, and The Washington Post, among other publications. She currently lives in New York City, where she joins me from. The website for more is at jessacrispin.com. The book is published by Melville House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jessica Crispin. Ms. Crispin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Now, as I was talking just before we started, I enjoyed the book. As much as I enjoyed it, it made me uncomfortable. I guess it's supposed to do that, isn't it?
Well, you know, societal reform doesn't happen if everybody's feeling really comfortable, so I think that's okay.
Yeah, I guess that's the problem that you have with the word feminist, or the concept of so-called feminism, is that it has become too comfortable, or has made us feel too comfortable over the years. When did that happen for you?
When did I, or when did I notice it happening?
When did you notice it happening, and then when did you realize, yeah, maybe I shouldn't be part of this, and I shouldn't use this word, as we all have, I guess.
I guess it's been an encroaching feeling. I don't think there was any one moment where I just said, fuck it. I think it was just a slow feeling of alienation. I came out of a very conservative place, Kansas, a very small town, very Christian town. So my introduction to feminism was quite late, I think, in my early 20s. I didn't have that kind of a political understanding until I managed to leave Kansas, right? And so my introduction to feminism was through feminist work. It was through advocacy. It was through my day job at Planned Parenthood. It was through my volunteer work. And so it's a very, I think, a different thing than coming at it through an abstract. Because I think if you are dealing with feminism in the abstract, your reference point is mostly your life. So you can kind of make the mistake of assuming that if your life is okay, then feminism is working out all right. But if you're kind of in contact with, I was in Texas and my colleagues were in Texas, with women who couldn't get abortions, who couldn't afford abortions, women who were raped, women who were in abusive situations, women in poverty, then you have a kind of different reference point. And so from that, I just noticed a growing disconnect between feminist rhetoric and how the majority of women in this country actually live their lives. And it just became kind of more and more disturbing as I went along.
Yeah, well, one reads your book and then realizes that it's not really about, say, the roles that men and women have in society, but really it's a class thing where you're seeing when women enter a certain class, the political class, the business class, that they're not doing anything differently than, say, men. And that really has to do with capitalism, is it? And how intertwined the patriarchy is with capitalism.
Yeah, and I feel like this has been... a problem with almost every marginalized group who gets the opportunity for assimilation. And it's always a select group that is allowed access. It's always the part of it with the most power. But once you're actually allowed to participate in things like corporate culture, then you stop criticizing corporate culture, or at least you stop calling for its destruction. Yeah. Then it just becomes, oh, well, we can just reform it, that sort of thing. But what you're doing is you're abandoning the people who have no power, who have no capital, who have no ability to actually affect change in any real way, because they're disenfranchised or alienated. And so it becomes a very kind of selfish mode of, you know, oh, we'll work for our own interests, and I'm sure it'll trickle down eventually.
So it does, you have seen, and we have seen, I guess, in society, in politics, and business, that women who do advance really are just doing things that men are doing.
Sure. I mean, you don't get ahead if you're a political radical. You know, you're not going to get ahead into Wall Street if you're showing up with your communist T-shirt every day, if you're spouting Marxist rhetoric. They're not gonna give you the opportunity to enact real reform from within the system. And so I've had this argument over the past week with some of my friends who feel like I'm too strident. But what is the actual what actually causes change? Is it reform from within, or is it a kind of abstention from participating? And I think actually both needs to happen. I think that there do need to be kind of aware people within the systems to reform them and decrease power inequalities. But there also have to be the voices from the wild saying this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I find that in most of feminism today, it's arguing for the reform from within, and that there are fewer and fewer voices from the wild calling for real destruction and recreation.
And so how do you see that happening in society today? I mean, a lot of people would be uncomfortable with sort of being strident or reforming. How does one start?
One has to be converted. I think that's the first step of any kind of radicalization process, is you have to have that moment of seeing the world in a different way. And within the feminist movement, that used to happen through mentoring, but for some reason, in between, let's say, second wave and third wave, there was this kind of break where the second wave became embarrassing. And this holds true to today, this idea that the second wave, the more radical parts of the second wave, they went too far. They're kind of held up as these boogeyman archetypes of the bra burners, or the women, you know, the women who refuse to shave their legs and that sort of stuff. Now the aesthetic is much more, you know, polished and selfies and lipstick and this idea of acceptability. But behind that is an urge for male approval, for approval from the system, a desire to get ahead. But I think that a lot of that is unconscious. You know, you can think and you can speak in the kind of feminist rhetoric of, yeah, that's the story of the patriarchy. But if you think that patriarchy is just men, rather than understanding that it's about a society structured around hierarchy, then you holding a position of power doesn't mean the end of the patriarchy. It just means that you're part of the patriarchy. Women can participate in the patriarchy, and I don't think that there's enough self-awareness about that.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing Christians and people on the right calling themselves feminists. Ivanka Trump, for example, probably thinks she's a feminist, right?
Yeah, and the pro-lifers are using it now, and the fundamentalist Christians are using it now. So the word has become very twisted, because now the idea is just that feminism is about women working in their own self-interest, and any kind of ideology or philosophy from the movement has been excised.
Well, whose fault is that? Do you think it's the marketer's fault? Because it has been hip to be feminist. I mean, males are using it as well. I mean, Is that an evolution that you've seen, that you've, I guess in the book you decry it, don't you?
Yeah, and I guess it's just everybody's fault, you know. Mm. Once women started to have money, people wanted women to give that money to them, you know. So it became a marketing tool. It became a way of men trying to get laid. It became a way for pop stars to sell records. It became a self-empowerment idea rather than a societal reform idea. And again, I think that's just something that happens. You know, certainly there are people still working in the LGBTQ community who would lobby the same criticisms against a lot of the gay rights movement, which has been so focused on marriage equality for so long, which is definitely, that's a policy of assimilation and conformity. Mm. That's not widening the idea of what's acceptable in society. That's just saying, you know, will you accept us if we behave like you? And I think that's part of the feminist thing too, is that, you know, male society accepts women in it mostly when they behave like men.
There's a chapter near the end of the book where you talk about how the safety of women has been used to dehumanize men, and especially incarcerate black men. Could we touch on that for just a second? Because people listening to us likely haven't read the book yet, and I think this is a great way of sort of talking about that part of the book, say.
Yeah, I think that... I also feel like it's not just about incarceration. It's also been used as a way to justify military intervention, you know, this idea that we have to protect women by invading the country and killing everybody. So there is this idea that women need to be protected, right? But this is an idea that originates from men, that we... these sort of white knight ideas of women being vulnerable, women being unsafe, and they need to be protected because they're weak, which has been used for centuries, or probably longer than that, as a justification for violence. But there are a few ideas from these kind of patriarchal notions that women have decided to keep because it's convenient for them. And one is that women need to be protected. And so you see in the judicial process this idea that, like, for example, the idea that rape is a hate crime and should be prosecuted as such. Now, that impulse comes from a long history of violence against women not being taken seriously. It's taken seriously when it's like a specter of immigrants coming in and raping and all that kind of stuff. But when it's intimate partner violence, when it's domestic violence, when it's date rape, these types of things, they're not and have not been taken seriously by police, by the courts. And so this frustration builds up. And now that we have an opportunity to have our needs met, we're maybe overemphasizing. We're maybe trying to overcompensate a bit by saying, rape is a hate crime, domestic violence is a hate crime. But all that does is it creates higher sentences for men, even though the whole prison system is an obvious nightmare, and even though it does absolutely nothing to rehabilitate, it's only about punishment. It increases the potential for somebody to reoffend.
Right.
But instead of reforming that system, instead of trying to replace the system, we just decided, no, we're good with it. We want more of it. It's good for us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very selfish way of looking at it. And it's that thing of like, we're in something that we know is wrong and we know is evil because it's convenient for us. And the way that we're doing it is by using these old patriarchal notions of our need to be protected. And we're not thinking about what the consequences of that is.
Yeah. You get a lot of people in the course of having, you know, written the book and now published it, a lot of men especially coming to you and asking you, well, asking you to enlighten them, say?
Yeah, I think that this is a common experience for a lot of feminists and just sort of women in public, are men coming to them with, you know, please enlighten me, please do the intellectual and emotional work for me so I don't have to do it. That thing of like, well, can you just recommend some books? I'm like, well, look, Google some shit. Look at, like, this is not my job.
Yeah. And so that obviously takes time away from toppling the patriarchy and the sort, that because, you know, the people just don't want to get their own shit together, I guess.
Look, if men had figured out that feminism actually happened,
yeah,
we would have known about it by now, and and they haven't. And it's cute, but it's not my job. And I really do feel like, and you see women just like bending over to these men because they want men to get it, right? They
yeah.
want men to be enlightened because they want good colleagues and they want good lovers and husbands. And so you can feel them just like begging men to just come around to the idea. But I think that's a waste of time.
Yeah.
We're better off figuring out how to live lives away from men. Than trying to drag men into being, human beings.
Yeah. You write in the book about the publishing business and how it's largely dominated by women.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, though, there's this less dominant conversation happening, a necessary conversation that needs to happen in terms of having that business more accessible to minorities, especially writers of color and the sort. Do you think it's getting better, though?
Yeah, and that's actually kind of funny, in the sense that it changed really fast, or at least the conversation changed. You're still not seeing equal rates of publishing and equal opportunities and, you know, equal advances and that sort of stuff, but you are seeing over the past year, and it was just that kind of thing where the gap between the book being written and the book being published, where the conversation changed really fast. And so there is a increased effort to find writers of color and to publish them and to give them a platform. So that was an unexpected twist in the story of my manuscript. But I think it's a wonderful, and I think, you know, with the Oscars last night, even with Moonlight winning, there is a shift happening with the balance of power with the races as just as a kind of awareness. And it's going to take a long time for it to, a very long time, I think, to even out, because women have been at this for 100 years and there's still not parity for us.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the blindness to the problem has begun to end.
Yeah. I'm sure you follow politics and you've seen the Prime Minister in Canada appoint a cabinet that's 50% women. Do you think when you look at how the lot of women has progressed, do you think that's a good thing, and do you think that should be emulated in other countries, say?
I do, but I also think that there has to be some sort of distinction between what's good for women and what's good for feminists, as far as what the agenda is. So when you put forth quotas like that, that does tend to help bring about gender parity, but it doesn't necessarily bring about feminist reform, because, again, this is about participating within the system rather than breaking the system apart. So I guess part of that is the idea of whether or not Hillary Clinton would have been, the election of Hillary Clinton, whether or not that would have been a feminist victory. And I say no, because she has a terrible record as far as promoting legislation that actually helps the lives of women. And she has a long history of promoting military interventions that causes the pain, suffering, and death of women around the world. So it's a pro-woman victory in the sense that, okay, now this is a thing that we have accomplished, but it's not a feminist victory because it doesn't actually do anything to change our society built on hierarchy. It doesn't put forth a feminist agenda. It's just kind of a surface-level change.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing that people have been thinking about since November, about Hillary Clinton, and because I guess it's just too simplistic to say that she lost because of racism or misogyny, right?
Right. 29 million women voted for Donald Trump, so it's a convenient excuse to say that racism and misogyny caused the downfall of Hillary Clinton, but that's useful to her as a way of looking at the society and her supporters. But it's actually, women voted for Donald Trump and claimed that that was a feminist decision, that they were making a feminist decision because they were making the choice and they were voting in their own self-interest. So again, it's a question of values and morals rather than whether or not, a woman has internalized misogyny, as the feminists love to call it.
Yeah. You assail in the book the whole self-help culture and that how it hasn't been helpful and that it's contributed to greater anxiety. How did you come to realize that over the years?
Oh, I mean, just being a woman and constantly bombarded with messages about how my body is a nightmare and my career is going nowhere. You know, like the women's culture, mainstream women's culture, especially coming out of places like fashion magazines and women's literature, is all about fixing yourself. It's all about finding your flaws and then fixing them. And that this is the basis of what's wrong with your life. It's not about society being against you, and it's not about entrenched misogyny in the culture. It's because you have daddy issues or you have cellulite, and if you get rid of those, then your life is amazing after that.
Yeah, this narcissism. How do we get? I mean, it's one thing, you know, for men to say, you know, not feed on or prey upon these issues, but women, I mean, what do you tell women in terms of how to get away from that?
Well, it's complicated, and I don't think that anybody, unless they just decide to go build a house out of sod on the Kansas prairie and live without electricity, I don't think it's actually possible to get 100% out of this culture.
Yeah.
But you can choose where to put your attention. And where you pay attention, that tells us what you value, you know. Are you paying attention to fashion magazines? Are you paying attention to how much money you're making? Are you paying attention to this wider culture that wants you to believe that you're worthless? Even if you think that you're fighting against it, you are absorbing that. And there is a way to kind of consciously turn away from it, to just refuse to participate. And that means not watching television, and that means working in a career that actually has meaning for you, and so on and so forth. But there is a reluctance. Contemporary society has a lot to do with conformity, and everybody wants to share the same entertainment experiences and watch the same shows, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, they want to be able to participate in the same conversation, but that conversation is thick.
Yeah.
And there is a feeling of, if you don't keep up, you're going to somehow fall so far behind, you'll never regain anything. But that's a trick, you know. Participating in the society does get you something if you do it well enough. It can get you money and security and comfort. But ultimately, contemporary culture is meaningless. It carries absolutely no meaning for, you know, the soul. The word "the soul" makes people uncomfortable today, but I feel like it's actually useful to think about.
Yeah.
That contemporary culture is soulless.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so if you live, if you decide to live on the margins, then it is possible. You're not going to get the material rewards, but you get some agency, and you get some soul back, and you get some meaning. But those are things that are not valued in our culture.
So how hopeful, then, are you, Jessa, that, people will get uncomfortable and will do the things that they need to do to regain their soul? I mean, it just seems impossible, is it?
No, it's not impossible. I'm completely optimistic, or else I wouldn't have bothered. I just would have screamed into a pillow for the next 2 years. I do feel like we're getting more and more uncomfortable in an involuntary way. Employment is much more unstable. Money is much more unstable. We're being forced to really look at the foundations of our society because the foundations are cracking. And so you can respond in a way where you're conscious of what's happening, where you're aware of the mechanisms of the culture and your participation within that. Or you can just be kind of blind and surprised and deal with the consequences of that blindness. But I think eventually things seem to be moving to a place of crisis, right? Especially with the rise of the far right worldwide. It's not just happening in America. And so I think that we have to be aware of that. And that the only way to kind of take control back of your life, to regain agency, is to be aware of what's happening. But people really do kind of have to be dragged kicking and screaming to that place. But hey, we're all being dragged kicking and screaming at this point. So I think that I really do believe that things can get better, or I wouldn't have written the book.
Yeah. And so what have you heard from people who've read the book so far? I mean, are people taking to the message, or have they told you how they feel about it?
Mostly I've been hearing the bad things so far.
Yeah.
But I've gotten some nice messages, too. There's certainly been within the feminist community a sense of relief from some people that these things have been articulated, because people have been kind of disenchanted with the feminist movement for a while now. And while there have been very vocal critics, they have not been getting necessarily a large platform. Mm. So for this book to get kind of a good platform is surprising to both, its author and its audience, I think.
Well, it's an engaging book, and it's one that I was going to say I enjoyed reading, but it made me uncomfortable as well. But it's a book that people need to read, and it's what a book should be. It should make you feel something at the end of it, whether it's uncomfortable or not. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with the book. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Why I Am Not a Feminist, A Feminist Manifesto. It's published by Melville House. Jessa Crispin, its author, joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.